I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
More from, well, me later as we discuss what it's like using Apple Pay. Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson. Now, normally, this is the part of the show that Ian says hello, and I say that we're going to start with this week's picks from the UK tech news. But Ian is in bed with the plague, or something ill. He's not very well. Poor Ian. Do wish him well on podcast@natelangson.com, of course. So this week, we've got a slightly tweaked show. We've got an interesting feature about Apple Pay, in which, in no small part, will I be basically interviewing myself. And we're also going to be talking to Andrew Hoyle of CNET.com about Formula E. He went down to Battersea, where the Formula E, the electric Formula One, was taking place. He spoke to Richard Branson. He got to record some of the cars. And there's some really interesting stuff going on the tech side of Formula E, not least the ability for the most popular racers, that is, racers, the humans, to gain a speed boost simply by having more Twitter followers. Very controversial as far as I can see, so we've got a section about that coming up later. We've also got some of your feedback that we're going to get to. So still a pretty packed show, but not so much with the news. But there is one news topic that I have to talk about because, frankly, I'm slightly disgusted. And this is the fact that ripping music and films is once again illegal in the UK after a high court overturned a law made in October last year. Now, as a bit of background here, in October, it was made legal for people to actually rip CDs for their iPods. So this is something that not a lot of people actually knew was illegal, but it technically was very hard to enforce, but technically illegal. The idea of buying a CD, putting it in your computer, and then making a copy to put that onto your iPod for listening. You paid for the music, but music bodies, such as the ones we're going to be talking about today, actually say you shouldn't do that, and that artists should be compensated for that additional copy. And basically, maybe you should be paying twice for that album, one for your CD, one for your iPhone. It's never been clear exactly how such things should be enforced, and despite a few months, almost a year, of it being technically legal, a sudden breakthrough of common sense there, it's now illegal again. So, where does this put us? Well, it means that technically now, you, if you buy a CD, and I know there are some of you, and I'm one of them as well, it's illegal for you to put that on your iPod or your iPhone or your Android or whatever it is. And it's absolutely bonkers. Now, I've referred to a BBC article that came out a few days ago. And there's a quote in here from the CEO of UK Music, which is an industry body here that allegedly works to protect copyright holders and artists. And here's a quote from Joe Dipple, the CEO of UK Music. Can't get much higher than that. Joe says, "Last month, the High Court agreed with us that government acted unlawfully when it introduced an exception to copyright for private copying without fair compensation. We therefore welcome the court's decision today to quash the existing regulations. It is vitally important that fairness for songwriters, composers, and performers is written into the law. My members' music defines this country. It is only right that government gives us the standard of legislation our music deserves. We want to work with government so this can be achieved." And the Musicians Union also took part in the action, according to BBC. Now, that's Joe Dipple, CEO of UK Music's view. And I generally aim to offer two sides to every discussion we have on this show, but this is a topic to which there is no suitable other side to discuss, as far as I can see. Decisions like this one are surrounded by a horde of misguided ideas and absolute ignorance, essentially. And it's actually baffling to assume that any family could even consider buying one copy of an album for their CD player at home and another copy of the same album for their iPod, another for each of their two children's iPods maybe, and maybe even another one for a spouse. that's the only way these artists are even going to get compensated, because how else are you supposed to give money from your machine or what have you to an artist or to a royalty collection agency simply through the process of turning a CD into an MP3 for your own use? I mean, even prior to the advent of digital reproduction that MP3s enabled, nobody would buy 5 copies of a vinyl or CD for every person in the house. There was a rule where blank audio CDs did come with a royalty payment to an industry body, but how would that actually ever get to the artists? You know, I mean, it's impossible to know that I was copying, let's say, Flesh God Apocalypse and Cattle Decapitation's new CDs onto a blank CD. No, it would go to a central pot and be divvied out. At the moment, it's been less true today than ever that these sorts of personal copying practices do not necessarily need to be in place, or at least money does not need to be given for these additional copies being made. I mean, when we look at something like Spotify or Apple Music, they offer one subscription to power multiple devices' catalogs of music. The only goal, as far as I can see, that moves like the one we're discussing today score is to perpetuate an outdated mode of thinking. It's an own goal, actually, because the publicity that it gets does nothing to earn public support for the industry bodies allegedly trying to help artists maintain a creative advantage to British musicians. Frankly, I would actually be hanging my head in shame if I had to work at an industry body that put me on the front page of a newspaper or a podcast or a website cheering the great advantage to Britain that these sorts of decisions make. That's before we even get into how ridiculous laws like this will ever be enforced. I buy CDs several a month, actually, and I have a subscription to Apple Music and Spotify. I know that I'm a valuable customer to the music industry, and I'm disgusted, basically, that any portion of the money that I give goes in any way to support these sorts of backward moves for an industry that, despite a decade of controversy with piracy and challenges, has finally started to move forward with innovation and innovative solutions to what is basically an overwhelming love for music globally. Joe Dipple, UK Music, I think this is a joke, and your praise of these decisions to the court to do nothing but to further highlight in the public eye how out of touch with every music lover in the country you are. And I invite you to come onto the show to discuss it fairly. I would give you an entire episode just to this topic, in fact, because as far as I can tell, all decisions like this do is put Britain on a list of nations that deserve to be mocked. But anybody can get in touch, obviously, podcast@natelangson.com. Now, elsewhere in the news this week was Apple Pay, and I, for one, dearly enjoyed the number of websites and blogs that had first-hand, hands-on experiences of paying for things with a phone and a watch, and lots of photographs of wrists being placed near card readers. It was gripping, innovative stuff. Loved it. If anything, one of the reasons maybe why it is actually, if we're honest, so tedious is because the technology does seem to work pretty well. If it was actually difficult to use or came with huge numbers of problems, then maybe personal stories about what it's like to use would be a bit more interesting to read. But nonetheless, we had planned on doing an Apple Pay segment this week. Ian was going to come into town. We were going to have lunch and pay for things with Apple Pay. And it was going to be frightfully interesting to sort of narrate the experience. Now, he didn't. But that's not a problem, because I came up with an innovative solution. It's groundbreaking. We are going to try an experiment now with a live interview of myself in the past using Apple Pay. So, without further ado, over to me, who I believe is walking through London's Finsbury Square on my way to buy lunch. Actually, no, I'm on Moorgate. Well, at least the lunch part was correct. I found somebody who has got an Apple Pay bank, or a bank that actually supports Apple Pay, and I'm en route to Starbucks. I'm going to pay for what I can only assume will be a sausage or bacon-based piece of produce. Now, walking through the door, so far everything is exactly the same as I was expecting it to be had this been done with cash. Now let's see if this changes the selection experience. He has picked an all-day breakfast butty. So far nothing has changed. This is exactly as we would be expecting. Just waiting to be served now. So the phone has just come out. He's now loading up Passbook. You can see on screen an image of a credit card, a virtual credit card. The message says, hold near reader to pay. Slightly premature. Sausage has not been heated yet. We still have a cold sausage, but the phone is ready.
Hi. Hello. May I pay with this with Apple Pay, please?
Yeah.
We've confirmed that the staff do indeed know that Apple Pay exists. They are ready. We're moving towards the till now.
Yes, please.
Okay. Finger is on the print reader. Oh, the card has been read. Okay. And that's it. $2.99 is on the screen. Pay has been completed. That was remarkably simple. Last transaction, London, England, just now, £2.99. So it doesn't tell you what the product was, but it does tell you that it was spent. So that took absolutely no more time than using a card. I suppose that is as advertised. I was expecting it to be more complicated than that. Some faffing around, experimenting with different types of fingering on the button, but no, it just took place.
And you hold it as you would hold a card, it's in the same area.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit of an update. We're done. Here comes the food. What a great day. What a great day for England, and there, of course, for the world. Process completed, minimum of fuss. Have to say that was almost tediously predictable. It worked fine. No faff, no fuss. And now my friend here is nourished, or will be nourished. Cash not required.
Thanks, Nate. Me. Now, I know Ian was going to join you for this shopping trip initially, but he is poorly, hence me needing to interview you about this. So how was the experience overall? Did it feel different?
No, not really. No, actually. I was sort of expecting it to be a bit more of a faff, a bit more pressing around different buttons and selecting card and the reader not accepting the card, or confused staff, which I found once in Boots. You have to ask them if you want to use contactless, and they sort of fluster around trying to work out how to enable it, so you end up taking more time just to get them to accept contactless than it takes you to put in a PIN. But it was actually fine. He did get his sandwich. He paid with his phone. I mean, that was the intended result. That is what happens.
Does the food taste any different?
No, it was still a sausage-based sandwich. Nothing changed there. Nothing remarkable.
Fair enough. Have you or anyone you've seen been using the Apple Watch to pay for anything yet?
That's a good question. No, sadly not. I was actually going to use it to take the tube in. I've seen a lot of journalists writing enthusiastically about paying money from the wrist instead of the fingers, so I wanted to experience the thrill firsthand. Or first wrist, if you will.
I certainly will. Okay, well, thanks, Nate, and I hope the rest of this section continues with this fantastic continuity, and I remember what you're going to say next.
Oh, I'm sure he will. Thanks.
Let us know if you've been using Apple Pay, podcast@natelangson.com. That is where you can get in touch and let us know, what was it like paying for things with your wrist or your iPhone? It might seem a bit of a stretch to say that a motor race can help save the world, but with Formula E, that's not such an outlandish statement. The new race series, held on the streets of cities around the world, uses cars that look almost identical to the vehicles seen in the globally popular Formula One series, but are powered entirely by electricity rather than petrol. Well, those were the words of Mr. Andrew Hoyle from CNET.com in an article titled How Formula E Can Overtake F1 and Help Save the World. Strong words, Mr. Andrew Hoyle from CNET.
Strong words indeed, but true words.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk a little bit about Formula E because you did this fab feature a couple of weeks ago, and I heard a lot about it on CNET's podcast that you co-host. And I was also particularly interested to hear about a particular aspect of Formula E that I think has something in common with things like pay to win in games, micropayments, all sorts of things coming to the racing world. But first, with your permission, because you went to Formula E and you recorded some Formula E vehicles, I wanted to hear what Formula E electric cars sound like. So we've got a clip that you recorded. Here it is. So they sound like cars.
Well, they sound like sort of... I think they sound really cool. I think they sound kind of what future cars people thought in the 80s would sound like.
Something like the Jetsons.
Yeah, something that you're very futuristic and very different. I mean, certainly it's very different from that ear-splitting whine of typical F1 cars.
Mm. So what is a Formula E race like, I mean, in person? Obviously, it's electric cars. That's kind of the whole point. So there's probably this air of... futureness, like we're getting away from fuel, we're not burning fossil fuels and destroying the planet to race. But what's the atmosphere like? Are they the same people that go to these things? Who's involved?
I think very similar, yeah. And it's one of the main benefits of Formula E is that they're actually bringing this into city centres. So the London race was actually held inside Battersea Park, which is right in the centre of the capital, which is brilliant because it means that people don't have to drive sometimes, you know, a couple of hundred miles to go to a dedicated racetrack. I mean, I had to drive halfway across the continent to go to Le Mans, which, of this dedicated racetrack in France. You know, you don't have to have that with this. You don't have to drive to Silverstone, which is, I'm not even entirely sure where Silverstone is, but it's quite a way away. And so it's really exciting. I mean, people who live in London and families and schools and things can come along and see this. But the race itself is every bit as exciting as a standard motor race because they're still going incredibly fast down these small, tight tracks and with the same cornering. And the cars look pretty much the same and they have similar performance, actually. So it's, in terms of it being like an exhilarating event, it's got everything that F1 has.
Do the cars look the same as F1 cars?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Because, I mean, in my head still, I mean, I know we've got the Tesla that's kind of an edge case, but to me, an electric car is things like the Nissan Leaf and the people that park them, you know, the opposite way around in spaces just to prove that they're doing something differently from normal cars.
Yeah, no, these are very different. They do look exactly like F1 cars. They've, you know, that whole very low thing looks a bit like an arrow, and it'd be designed obviously with the same aerodynamics in mind as F1 so that you can get the best performance, the best efficiency.
I'm looking at a quote in your CNET article from Richard Branson, who said, Formula E makes green energy sexy. If you go back 10 or 20 years, people thought electric cars were something granny drove. Now they see wonderful hybrids looking sleek, looking sexy, and that puts a spur on the revolution the world needs. It's going to be a very exciting revolution. Now, if I was to read the subtext in that, that is basically Formula E exists to help push the agenda of electric vehicles.
Yeah. And that's no bad agenda to push, because the benefit with this is not only is this going to help sort of drive it forward as a motorsport, this is going to get people excited about electric cars. This is getting people thinking, oh, okay, electric cars, you know, maybe they've read some headlines, they've seen a couple of Top Gear episodes where people believe that, oh, electric cars just aren't really important. You know, they haven't got the range, you haven't got the battery capacity. Whereas this is actually getting people excited and thinking, oh, wow, okay, so battery tech in cars has got a place in motor racing and therefore in motoring in general. The second part, of course, is that this is actually helping develop that battery technology, things that they're learning to do here in terms of efficiency of the battery and in using brakes to actually harvest energy to then put back into that battery. Those things are all going to be sort of filtered down into road cars, which will help sort of push that technology forwards.
Well, one of the other aspects of Formula E that I found most interesting, and this is the thing when I was reading your feature, this is the thing that stood out to me. One of my eyebrows distinctly heightened relative to its partner on the front of my head. And this is something called fan boost. Now, to me, this is something that feels like it undermines the skill required to win a competitive sport like a car race, because it is essentially people who can essentially vote for their favorite driver, and the person with the most votes gets a 5-second boost on their time.
That's exactly it. They get a slight increase in speed. So I think 180 kilowatts an hour is the battery capacity normally, but with fan boost they get 5 seconds at 200 kilowatts, which, you know, they can deploy at any point for maybe an overtake or something.
I know this isn't your idea, but I have to grill you because I know that you you interviewed people about this, and there's a big section about this in your feature. It feels like obviously it's just a popularity game, but why should having more fans mean that you get the potential to deploy that magic button like that? It's the nitro boost equivalent out of Fast and Furious.
It is. So I agree with that, and that was my first comment, and it's also been the comments of most of the motoring industry. That feature hasn't really gone down that well, and it's understandable. However, the argument that they're using is that what this is doing is allowing just a much, much bigger audience engagement for a new racing series, for new technology, allowing people to actually get involved and talk to the racers and the drivers
and the teams on Twitter.
Well, they can, but now they've got more of a reason to really get involved and for the drivers to have more of an incentive to talk to the fans and to do signings and do, oh, come along to the Formula E race and tweet at them and putting things on Facebook and basically getting more people involved and getting people aware that this race exists in order to, so that hopefully they will then get these fan boosts. And the actual boost itself is very, very small. It certainly won't really change the outcome of a race.
Well, you say that, but I mean, these are races that are, you know, they have partners from, you know, people like Tissot and Swatch and stuff for timing that are measured in fractions of a second because those fractions can matter. I mean, in that context, that 5 seconds of potential additional speed could make the difference, if not between winning and losing, could be in the difference between second and third place.
Yeah,
which can be huge. I mean, in the gaming, I liken this at the beginning of this segment to something out of the gaming world, which is pay to win, which is something that's always really controversial in competitive games online, not so much single player games, but ones where you're playing against other people, where essentially if you're happy to pay for, you know, more powerful spells or you know, bigger swords in a game purely by just throwing cash at the developer, then you get a competitive advantage over another player. And it's always a controversial move. Gamers generally tend to frown upon these things because it looks like a money grab. This isn't a money grab, but it does feel like a something grab, and I haven't put my finger on
it. Well, in a pay to win then sense, how is that much different then from Formula One generally, where the teams with the most money will win because they can throw all the money that in the world at developing a car that's physically more capable than other cars? Like that already is the case, and they achieve better performance in their cars because they've got more money.
I think it's a fair comeback. I suppose the difference is that everyone is trying to spend as much money on developing this technology and trying to develop different types of technology.
But not everybody has that money. It's like you playing Elder Scrolls as you do and saying, oh, you know, well, I could throw money at this and I could throw however much cash at buying upgrades and buying health boosts and stuff so that when you're in battle, you'll be the one that wins. But a 14-year-old kid who only just managed to be able to afford to buy the game doesn't have that same amount of money. He's still playing the same game, still wanting to play it just like you, but there is that money difference there, and there is that in F1 too. At the end of the day with this is not something that's going to stick around. Fan boost is not going to be forever in their racing series. They've already said that. It was sort of a short-term
publicity stunt,
absolutely. But that's no bad thing, to try and get people involved in this at an early stage, particularly something when it's already in the cities. They're trying to bring people to this to get excited about something. And I think actually something that has the noble cause of driving forward electric technology that will be the thing that helps our planet survive in the future, fine, great, do what you need to do to get people involved.
Fair enough. Well, I mean, it's good to see. This is something that's happening in the UK. Obviously, that's the reason we're talking about it. This was held in Battersea, Virgin's involved. But Formula E has worldwide ambitions. I know it's been done in other cities around the world. And it's an exciting new thing. I mean, it's weird because I'm not into motorsport at all. But the reason I wanted to talk to you about this is when I read this, I found myself being interested in motorsport in a way that I haven't been in the past, because it's to do with electric vehicles. Because as you say, it's more in the public consciousness. The fan boost thing, that kind of social media aspect, you know, I agree, it does help engage people like me who are maybe on the periphery of being interested.
Yep.
Just push me over the edge. So that's great. Well, anyone listening can make a note of, if you just search Formula E CNET, you will find Andy's article. And
you might find it.
You might
search Formula E Save the World.
Fair enough. That will find it. And there's some fantastic pictures in there and a hell of a lot more that we didn't get time to talk about today. Andrew Hoyle, CNET.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, it's time to move on to some feedback. We've got quite a stuffed inbox of emails that we've had over the last 2 or 3 weeks, and we will get through them all over the next few weeks. It's good to have some a bit of backlog. Now, I don't know about you, dearest of listeners, but I'm getting a little bit fed up of my own voice on this show today. So In the interest of having a bit of vocal diversity and a bit of excitement on this show, I'm going to introduce an entirely new voice. An entirely new voice to read out each of these emails. We're going to do a couple, and I'm extremely excited to welcome this voice onto the show. And it is going to start by reading an email from Tim.
Really liked the session on Minecraft this week. As a dad of an 8 and 10 year old, I can tell you my boys love the game. But what I find strange about it is the amount of time they spend watching other people play on the game through YouTube. And yet they learn an incredible amount through this medium. I'm pleased to see that educators and the various companies involved in education seem to be picking up on this finally. For me though, the best part about the game is the way it allows me to connect with my children. For many reasons, I don't see them in person as often as I'd like. However, having the chance to meet up with them for a virtual fishing trip or caving adventure from a hotel room after a hard day's work can really brighten up my day. Keep going with the podcast. I know you have many fans out there, Tim.
Very true. Thank you very much indeed, Tim. And Fiona, of course, for reading that on behalf of Tim. I think that I can relate to this, definitely having family living elsewhere in the country. And although my grandma does not play Minecraft yet, give her time, the ability to get FaceTime video calls, incoming FaceTime video calls from a grandparent to me is pretty amazing. Even though video calling has been around for a long time, that's something that I think Apple really nailed on the head, and it definitely allows us to feel closer, even though I don't get to see them anywhere near as much. So it's really interesting that Minecraft can offer a similar sort of thing for modern dads and sons, daughters. It's really good. So thanks very much for getting in touch, Tim. Well, we have another email that I want to get to, and of course, in the interest of diversity, I have chosen to pick a voice from another part of the world. And this is to read out an email we've had come in here from Richard.
I was born in 1979. I have never considered myself a millennial. However, my eldest son was born in 2001, so he definitely is. My wife and I have three other sons aged 10, 7 and 5, and with the exception of live sports, Wimbledon, World Cup, Six Nations, Olympics, we watch practically zero live TV. We record everything we want to watch. Series Link is a wonderful invention on the Sky Plus box so that we can watch it when it is convenient, and so that we can forward through all the adverts and rubbish filler to the actual parts that interest us. For kids shows, the boys all watch using Netflix on their iPads, and virtually never even turn on the TV. My wife and I usually work our way through box sets on Netflix too. For the boys, we have hundreds of kids' DVD, but in the past few years they basically just gather dust. It's just old technology. That means finding the right one, the right remote, and having to put something away again. If it isn't on Netflix, at a few presses away, they just don't bother watching it. If it wasn't for live shows, we wouldn't even bother having a Sky box either. The day is coming where we will hopefully be able to get rid of it completely and save the £51 per month. Absolutely love your podcast. I listen to them all, and my co-workers all listen to them too. Regards, Richard.
Well, Richard, I think your wife and you both have very similar habits to my girlfriend and I. Anything on a box in a disc rarely gets watched, with the one exception, actually, I have to say, of Star Trek Voyager, which Kate has on a DVD box set, which every now and again we find that streaming from the media server that's in my house to the laptop just gives up, and it is sometimes easier to put the DVD in the Xbox and press play. But that is one incredible exception to the rule. And thank you very much. I'm glad your colleagues enjoy the show. Hello to Richard's colleagues. Tell your spouses. Well, that's going to do it for this week. I know it's been a slightly odd show. I've got exactly 41 minutes until I have to leave my flat for a flight to New York. So some of this has been put together at the last minute. I hope it's still been enjoyable, and maybe you can let us know what you think to Tessa and Karen giving some vocal support to the program today. Let us know anything you want us to talk about in the future. podcast@natelangston.com. Hopefully Ian will return with a healed chest next week.
Imagine Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.